Okay, good morning, everybody. Well, I don't know it's morning for you, but welcome to the Eric Anders Lang Show. I'm very excited to be joined by, well, I mean, I don't know you, Daniel, but I know your work, and I've actually been a fan of your work since before I knew it was your work. I'm talking about the Brooks Koepka article that...
Oh, yeah, sure.
That Brooks Koepka article was... Anyway, we'll get into that. I'm fascinated to talk to you about Brooks, but you're a writer. Your bio says features editor.
Right.
You love golf. You live in New York. You grew up in L.A. What do you say when you meet someone in an Uber? What do you do, guy?
I'm a magazine editor, a magazine writer, and a novelist. So I've a couple books. Been working in magazines since right after college. In 2008, was at GQ as an editor for 12 years, just recently left and have my title's correspondent there. So I still do articles there and then kind of other mix of writing.
The world of a writer, is it as romantic as it is depicted in black and white movies?
I think, you know, at fleeting moments it is, but for the most part, it's not quite like it was maybe, or, you know, even through, I was just recently laughing with some friends who do magazine writing about like reading articles about the sports writers of the 90s and their $1 million contracts and all this stuff as the magazine world changes as much as it does right now or with publishing. And, you know, being able to write for a living is an amazing thing. Is it what it was in terms of that sort of stability and the big loft apartments in New York and the big houses out in Montana or whatever? Probably not. But I love it. I think that the people that can make it work, it's a really special and exciting thing, and we wouldn't change the work itself.
As a writer, you travel the world in search constantly, I presume, of a story. You're sure. Sort of always maybe trying to contextualize. It's almost like you're a comedian. You know, you're always trying to look at something through a lens, your lens, the writer's lens. What is that like? Is it that different? Have you been able to step outside of that experience as a writer?
So as an editor, it was really interesting working with as many writers as I did, because you got to ask that question that you just asked and kind of understand that about a lot of different writers. And I think it's different for everyone. For me personally, I feel like I flip on a switch that's almost like a camera lens or something that you're either on for me and all the details are kind of coming in and you're processing them. And that's what all the note-taking is. That's what, whether it's for a magazine story where you're with a subject and you're just fully absorbing all the little things around them and, every little thing they say and how that connects to something they maybe said 10 years ago and trying to connect all those things. Or I'm like, have it totally off and I'm not noticing almost anything and, you know, can walk through situations where, I'm missing things. I think some writers have it constantly on and that's sort of their mode. I'm definitely in or out, or, like when I'm writing fiction or those novels, like that's like the lens is open, you know, for a lot of the time and picking up lots of things that make it into the work. And but to your question about just like each of those different stories, what I love about magazine stories is they are sort of a discrete period of time that for that like 3 months or whatever that you're working on a Brooks Koepka story or something about a crime in Ukraine or a celebrity in Hollywood, is like you have that period of time where you're just absorbing everything about them and their kind of story and then trying to translate that into the best kind of most fresh and interesting and exciting kind of, you know, short form pop of that 4,000, 6,000 words, something like that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know why, but for some reason, when I'm watching a film, the writer is always my favorite character.
Sure.
I mean, clearly someone wrote the movie, so they relate to that, you know, title character, the lead role. But for some reason, I'm not a writer, but maybe I identify with writers in the sense that in this sort of movie depiction, that they're just sort of walking around asking at questions. And a lot of times I think, I know for me, I don't even know why I'm asking the question, and I don't, right. I don't really even need an answer. And, you know, a lot of times a great article basically does that without like nailing it on the head, you know, like a great piece of written form kind of leaves you not knowing more than knowing. Is that true? Or am I just talking out of my, you know?
No, I think that that's right. And I think that, I mean, one of the thing that a lot of journalists, especially magazine writers who are not necessarily pursuing like the specific answer to one question, as maybe a newspaper writer is in a certain kind of article, a magazine writer just has permission for this fixed period of time to ask any question, you know, of the people that are surrounding this story. If you're invited into that orbit, it's kind of an amazing thing that I don't feel like I have that permission in any other aspect of my life to, you know, some people do, they can walk right up to a table and butt right in or whatever. I actually am a pretty, you know, I'm a pretty quiet person generally and let people mind their own business until that flip is switched. And then it's right. Like you have hours and hours to pry and you kind of read that person to see, you know, what's too far. You can usually figure out like, you know, how to steer a conversation and that kind of ability to get into places and corners you don't even know where it's going can be, you know, that's really exciting stuff. But it was funny when you were talking about like walking down the street, those characters in movies or whatever. One of my good friends, who's a writer for the New Yorker and a bunch of other places, she, I remember once described like what she does as a professional noticer. And like, I always liked that just in the sense of, you know, you're just seeing, if you can see things that, other people can't when you're all staring at the same thing, that's a really valuable way to be able to kind of translate again in a way that makes you see something fresh again, especially if it's the kind of subject that a lot of people feel familiar with. I think those are the best kinds of pieces about, especially about famous people, when we've all been looking at them. And if you can find a way to see them new again, I think that people get really excited about that, to have that injection of sort of, I don't know, an exciting, fresh lens on that.
You just mentioned talking about something and seeing it in a way that no one's seen it before. You're a golf writer, not so much. You're a golf writer, maybe in the closet. You're a golf writer, maybe you don't want to be a golf writer. Maybe you write about golf in a way that no one else does. In any event, you write about golf for people that don't play golf.
Right, right. I mean, it's interesting because I've been at GQ for such a long time. There was really not a long. There's a lot of sports coverage at that magazine. Basketball players, football players, tennis players over the years, hardly ever any golfers. And it was just something I had in my back pocket for a long time. I think that the closet part is that I probably am more obsessed with golf than any other thing in my life. And it's the thing I'd written least about probably until the last, it was kind of funny, in 6 months, I had a short piece in the New York Times and then this Brooks Koepka piece, and was putting a lot into that. That I had probably been sitting on a little longer. But yeah, you are constantly calibrating audience, and golf is one of the strangest things to have to do that for, because you either know almost everything, you know, like you're the kind of person who's probably listening to this podcast or some others that are as obsessed as you and I are with this stuff, or you really, it takes a lot to try to convince you that this is something worth paying attention to. And of course there's a lot in the middle there, but it does seem fairly polarized in terms of something like that. And so that was an interesting piece where I hope that there were things that the people who already know a lot could find something new about Brooks Koepka. But also, if you had never heard of that guy or cared, and there were ways that you could frame his story, which I think is uniquely one in which it can appeal more widely, and also just kind of that question of, this guy is so immensely talented and had such incredible success, how do I not know about him? You know, that didn't happen with athletes very often. So that was very exciting for us to kind of be able to do a story like that for a general interest magazine.
You know, from a, you know, popularity aside, numbers aside, when we look at golf as a whole, from your perspective, from the writer's perspective, from the story perspective, it seems like it would be different, or it is different. Like there's something different between, I guess, articles, stories written about golf and articles and stories written about every other sport on planet Earth. You know, and it seems like you choosing to write about golf is not necessarily easier. It's probably not, you know, editors of magazines aren't saying, oh, he's got an article about golf. This is amazing. You know what I mean? Like, why is golf not interesting? Why is the stories in golf so hard to tell? I don't understand. You know what I mean? You must have thought about this.
Well, I think that the kind of like big obvious thing, at least in my life, and I was thinking about this a lot lately, just like in terms of my, I guess like you're saying, closeted obsession with all this stuff, is like, I have not grown up in a community where everybody played golf. My friends don't play golf. You know, I have a couple who do, but it really is like a cordoned off part of my life that I go out usually by myself to go do this thing again that I spend hours every day probably noodling on in some way or another, you know, like, I think that there is just a, maybe it's a cultural thing, I think, over the last 20 years, maybe, of just sort of being like, golf is trying to evolve into that mass appealing place at times, or at other times it is breaking itself so far off that it's just for the niche audience. Or I think that the professional game is a different experience than the, if you play, and that's like a very different kind of leveled off thing. And so I think it's just complex in that way, that it's not immediately easy to fall in love with it or care about it if maybe your only exposure to it is the, you know, Saturday or Sunday coverage for 3 hours in the afternoon that kind of has some cadences that have been the same for 20 or 30 years. And so I don't know, there are lots of little things like that. I think that I grew up in a situation where the public golf was accessible and mass appealing. I think I also know friends who only grew up, you know, with shitty public courses and then country clubs, and that's a huge cultural divide. I think that the kind of cliche of a country club, and that's where golf is played, still persists hugely. Where I live in New York, you know, like it's hard enough to play that if you do, you know, it's usually there's class elements to it. It's all sorts of things that it just doesn't become as immediately accessible, I think, as some of those other sports. And in that way, I just think that, I mean, this is sort of the stuff that you're up to and a lot of things right now that are like the future potential for that shift just feels so ripe right now. And that's what's very exciting about it is you know, the culture around the game seems to be shifting, but also all the old rules, just, I don't know if that divide, you know, if country clubs only or whatever exists. And so you have people like Koepka emerging into a conversation of wondering if that is broken and that golf needs to change in these ways. And maybe the PGA Tour will, or all the exciting kind of innovating going on in public golf. And, you know, in that way, I think that that will necessarily become more appealing. But for a long time, it has been kind of off in its corner.
You know, it's interesting, as you were talking about, you know, golf, I was kind of trying to think about other sports and why they're so much more popular. And I thought of something that hadn't really occurred to me. I mean, obviously you said, you know, it's very difficult, you know, it's time consuming and things. But in a sense, like, you can go to the park, throw a football, and then you, quote, understand football. You can throw a baseball, you can understand baseball. Tennis, I mean, you can just hit a tennis ball with a racket at any old court, and it's like, you got it. Golf is like, you need a piece of equipment that is sized to you. You need to, where are you going to hit this thing? You need three football fields just to hit like a wedge, you know? And it's strange, you know, like it's a very hard, and you know, so all these other sports, I mean, I would imagine, of all of the millions of people who watch football, when was the last time any of them touched a football, right? I mean,
right.
But golf, you almost need to be touching a golf ball in order to care about watching it on TV, unless you're talking about the majors or, I mean, right? I mean, that's so interesting that we have that like incredible moat around getting into golf, explaining golf, becoming a fan.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, there's a lot there. And I think that one of the, I mean, the other thing is you have to pay every time you play, which, you know, yeah. There are lots of places that are, you know, do great things to get around that. I grew up playing mostly courses that cost, you know, $5 a round for juniors and that, so that eliminated that, you know, hurdle, but that can be really challenging. I think that you're right though, that like you need that balance of the play and also the professional level to be in sync. And that's what's so exciting about the product, you know, especially I think of the NBA in the last 10 years is just that sort of ascendant, I don't know, the just sort of approachability of the players and the interest and in everybody up and down the bench. And I think that golfers are extremely interesting up and down the bench of professional golf. And the more you know, the more you're rewarded with interesting stories and personalities and everything. I don't necessarily know if the television coverage, you know, like highlights that quite as well as it could. And that's all kind of I think I dropped out for a second.
Yeah.
I just think that it can be challenging when you're coming in cold to pro golf on CBS or something like that to really find your handhold into the game. And so you really need, you know, people that are helping you find all those interest points and you know what you want to be reading and listening to. And I think that I've just noticed like, you know, so much new material in that way that can keep you interested and lead you into different corners of that world in a way that, you know, I played a lot growing up. I burned out pretty seriously, kind of like wasn't paying attention for a number of years and only maybe in the last few years, like really found that kind of resurgence, but it wasn't going through the old channels for me. It was all the new stuff that had emerged in that time to kind of remind me what was always so exciting about that. And I think that will be the deciding factor is like if that mainstream thing can get as interesting as what's happening at the edges.
You know, and then again, I'm sorry, I keep harping on this, but is there any other sport where you have to arrive with essentially a duffel bag with like 14 tools, 14 instruments for different reasons? That have cost you, I mean, on the low end, if you're quasi serious, you're going to spend $500 and that it's almost like medical instruments, really. I mean, they're relatively dangerous if misused. What is there's, I cannot think of another sport.
The only thing is ice hockey. And I remember growing up with a good friend and neighbor across the street who decided he wanted to play like one season and they bought all the stuff, you know, and you've got your like 100 pounds of equipment that you're slinging over your back to get to the rink and you're paying for the time and everything. And then it wasn't for him. And I was like, that was a pretty serious, you know, shelling out of cash for that. But there is like, right. Everything else is you can train at every level, socioeconomic level, to get better in that game in public areas. And that's a big difference. And like I said, I know, you know, the LA kind of public golf scene, but I just felt very lucky that there was a lot of options there. There was a great junior tour that I think still exists, the SCPGA that was, you know, it was cheap. I don't know how many courses how often they still play at country clubs on that little junior tour, but that was like my only access to a lot of those top end courses was, you know, you pay your $20 entry fee or whatever and get out there, which that was so key, you know. And but it wasn't like everybody was doing that or something, you know. You had to be seeking that kind of competition out, but that was really important.
So I like I said, I read the Brooks Koepka piece in GQ before I knew acquainted with your work. I don't think I realized at that time that you were a real writer. Do you know what I mean? Like, I mean, I obviously realized it was good and great and fascinating and long and like super in depth and you spent months on it. But it wasn't until I read the New York Times piece about golf in New York City that I really thought, wow, this is interesting. Like, this is not written the way I'm used to reading. And I think part of that is because a lot of reading that I do within golf is, like you said, more news, more like factual stuff. And I kind of wanted to just talk about the New York Times piece and, you know, like, you know, it's sort of this, like, it's kind of funny, and it's sort of about this experience that you have of the wonderful kind of, it's almost like New York in a microcosm. Like the greatest part about being in New York is that you are sandwiched together with a bunch of people you don't know. And you talk about that on the golf course and what that's like. Can you kind of like just tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. So the New York Times Magazine has this great weekly column that I love called the Letter of Recommendation. And I wrote one on basically playing golf off the waiting list. And grew up playing a lot of golf by myself in the afternoons on weekdays after school. Mom would drop me off, jump out with adults, generally, you know, all the way, maybe 10 to 18 when I went off to college. And so had really just kind of, that was second nature to me. But at the same time, as I maybe already said, like I was developing, I'm pretty insular and, you know, I'm not the kind of person that just jumps out and talks to strangers in every other capacity. And yet I'd kind of grown up with this thing, went away from golf a little bit, came back when I was living in New York City. And because I didn't really have anybody else that any friends that were playing would kind of fell right back into this thing. So going out to these New York City public courses and you're hopping in with you know, anybody. And obviously any golfer knows that experience of going out by yourself and just getting paired up with whoever and the people that you encounter. But it was the first time that it occurred to me that I had this sort of like very funny and unique secondary education of picking up all this, you know, for whatever reason, you see a 12-year-old by himself on a golf course, people start dispelling wisdom and, you know, their hard-won opinions of whatever it is, cities that are worth it or not, you know, who to date, who not to date, don't live in this kind of place, on and on. And picking that up again in New York was special just because, like I said, the kind of golf part of New York is not part of my daily life. And so whenever for me, it was hopping on the subway and then the LIRR to get out to Bethpage to play one of the five courses out there. And you know, just the people you end up with there, which that I think I say in the piece is, you know, the Carnegie Hall of playing off the waiting list is waiting to get out on the black there. And so, you know, that just felt like both an experience that a lot of people in New York have. And also I was finding it tying back to a lot of my experiences as a kid, and just kind of that value of, even if you're a person like I am, who doesn't make a habit of talking to strangers in every situation, it's a good, golf's one of those unique kind of havens where you can do that.
Yeah. I can't think of many, if any, places where you would basically show up to a place and then work on a puzzle for 4 hours with three people you've never met and then never see them again or see them again. And that's really not the main thing, you know?
Totally. And I always have this funny thing. Actually, another piece I wrote was about when you go to a wedding, particularly by yourself, or maybe you are seated at a wedding with another, you know, those couples you've never met, and you kind of are vibing with one of the other guys, and like for a night, he's like you're kind of your buddy, you know, or whatever, and you guys have like this you know, one night of being best friends out there, and you kind of go like, is this person actually one of, you know, is this going to be one of my good friends? And then of course you never see them again, and that is like how I feel with golf a lot of the times too. Or you have a good experience with somebody out there. You're like, well, sure, we're definitely going to play again next week and the week after that. And maybe this is one of my, but it's actually just one of those experiences in life where you go, oh, that's exactly what it was supposed to be. It's 4 hours. I'm never going to see this person again. You really lean into it and have a great time. But then you move on and you have that experience again the next time you go out. But yeah, I always think that, you know, I might keep in touch with somebody or whatever and never play with them again. But it's one of those things that is a nice, it's just kind of nice to dip in and out of that sort of thing.
All right, hitting you up at the ad break here. I got a couple to run through. Jones Golf Bags, y'all, made in Portland. These bags are, they go back to the 70s. You're going to recognize these if you're older, and if you're not, you're going to be like, those look retro. They're awesome. Well, they are awesome, and they're also wonderfully priced. They also have some random golf club bags. We are getting a new bag up and running, so check back on the website for that. We're currently sold out of all the current bags that we have through Jones. But stay tuned. You can sign up for the mailing list at randomgolfclub.com or head over to Jones Golf Bags. Follow them on Instagram, Jones_sports_co. They make the best bags in the biz. They've got dual straps, single straps. They probably have a triple strap. They've got stand bags. One of the best is I like the original bag. I like the player series. I also like the Ranger or the Rover, one of the two. Either way, I love that bag. And I love the guys that make up Jones. Very proud to welcome a new sponsor to the Random Golf Club universe. That's Whoop. You may have seen me wearing a, quote, watch on my right wrist. That's not a watch. It's a Whoop strap, Whoop. And they're offering a discount. I don't quite know what it is. It could be 15%. I don't know. It could be more if you use the code EAL. And my experience with this wonderful device, this wearable technology, is that it helps me get better sleep. It helps me understand the strain that I'm going through throughout the day, whether I'm, you know, on the bike, it connects to my Peloton, or whether I'm just walking 18 holes of golf, which, by the way, actually is pretty strenuous. I didn't really realize that's why I need a nap in the middle of the day, folks, if I play a 6 a.m. round. But definitely go check it out. You probably heard the news that they gave one out to every PGA Tour player, because it actually has been proven to help identify, subtle, I guess, biometric changes in your body that could lead to early detection of COVID. So, you know, a lot of reasons to try this thing. A lot of athletes have been loving it, obviously Rory and Justin Thomas. So check that out. All right, folks, features. Here's the thing about these socks. They're not spelled F-E-A-T. They're spelled F-E-E-T-U-R-E-S. The big thing about features is it's a small change that can make a huge difference. And we've all seen this in our swing changes, our swing thoughts, our swing tips. Maybe you change the ball. Maybe you play a vice ball. I don't know. But, these tiny little differences can make a huge impact on the game. And features is in that family as well. It's a compression sock. It's used for running. It's very breathable. And my experience with them is like, have you ever had a really, really good burrito? Right? And it's just like, it's not too wet. It's not too dry. It's perfect temperature. These are burritos for your feetos. I'm telling you, like, not, they're breathable burritos for your feetos. So definitely take advantage of this code here, folks. Anyway, coming to the end, feature socks will change how you feel about socks forever. And you can get a $10 off on your first pair of features when you use the code Eric, E-R-I-K, at features.com, F-E-E-T-U-R-E-S.com. Promo code Eric for $10 off your first pair. Just a couple notes on the sock itself. Targeted compression hugs the arch of your foot. Imagine that burrito getting down there on your feet. I was keeping the sock in place and preventing it from bunching, slipping, or sliding down into your shoe. Who likes that? I don't like that. They've fixed the problem that I don't like. The anatomical design conforms to the left and right shape of your foot, so get them on the correct foot, my friends. Creating an enhanced custom-like fit, kind of like a burrito. It reduces discomfort. I love reducing discomfort. Those two words are key. Also, they maximize comfort. I added that. And prevents blisters so you can focus on your game. Features helps enhance your game so you can play harder, faster, stronger. They wrote that. Anyway, they're good socks, I'll say. Lifetime guarantee. For the lifetime of who? You or the features are so durable and long-lasting that they will outlive you. No, they didn't write that. That if you're unsatisfied at any point, they'll give you a replacement pair. No questions asked. Features is a proudly family-owned business, and this is where we hit the metal to the road. The pedal to the metal, the road to the rubber. Hi, Hugh Gaither. Not high. I can't read. Hugh Gaither founded the company in 2002, and now he and his son John, both of his sons, John and Joe, own and operate the company in North Kakalaka, Carolina. Their mission is to create products that help you achieve your personal best. I can get down with that. Let's support Hugh, John, and Joe in their mission of reducing discomfort. No, but seriously, check out Features, F-E-E-T-U-R-E-S. Use the code ERIC to get $10 off and support a quality family-owned business down in North Kakalaka. TaylorMade, folks. TaylorMade is a family, and it's a team. They've been so generous with their staff players for the Ace Cam videos for us, and obviously the Sim Driver has changed my life. I can drive the ball 7,000 yards, and it hits me in the butt. It goes so far. But definitely check out all of the things from TaylorMade. I love those guys. Vice. It's a golf ball. It's got style. It's got class. But even more importantly, it performs as good as the top performing balls for half the price. So check out the Vice commercials. You may have seen those. I don't know if you have. Maybe you haven't. I don't know. We've got a random golf club ball coming out very soon. They're on a truck. I think we have, there's so many balls that they're bringing them in. I don't even know how they bring them in. They're probably not on a plane because it would weigh the plane down. I don't even know. Check up randomgolfclub.com for the Vice balls coming up. Precision Pro. Also big news for Precision Pro coming soon. You've heard me talk about it. I think I can definitively say we're going to be launching this in the middle of August. The Random Golf Club Precision Pro Rangefinder comes with free battery replacement for life. It's got a magnet on it. We're going to get the NX9 with the RGC branding. And then all of the other rangefinders they make are wonderful. It's a wonderful family operation up there in Cincinnati. Great crew. And then we have standby. All right. Now I realize why I was stumbling is because I didn't have what I needed to have to tell you about Keeps, folks. Did you know that 2 out of 3 guys will experience some form of male pattern baldness by the time they're 35? The best way to prevent hair loss is to do something about it while you still have hair left. That's the key. They didn't underline that, but I'm underlining it for you. Get treated from home. You used to have to go to the doctor's office for your hair loss prescription. Now, thanks to Keeps, you can visit a doctor online and get hair loss medication delivered right to your home. They make it easy and deliver your medication every 3 months so you can say goodbye to the pharmacy checkout lines, not fun during COVID, and awkward doctor visits. Keeps offers generic versions of the only 2 FDA-approved hair loss products out there. You may have tried them before, but probably never for this price. Quite possible. Prevention is key. Keeps treatments can take up to 4 to 6 months or more to see results, so it's important to act fast. Literally, press pause and get this. The sooner you start using Keeps, the more hair you'll save. You're not even saving money, you're saving hairs. We're splitting hairs here, folks. Okay, sorry, no, stop. Find out why Keeps has more 5-star reviews than any of its competitors, and nearly 100,000 men trust. That's an army. That's an army, folks. 100,000 hairy men, by the way. They're hairy for sure. Keeps Snowball. Snowball, you have enough hair. Relax. He's hypoallergenic, so he doesn't even lose it. It's like, come on, man. It's an embarrassment of riches over there, Snowball. It's all white, I know, but you were born with white hair. Okay, moving on. Keeps, their hair loss prevention medication. Keeps treatments starts at just $10 per month. Plus, $10 a month? That's a good deal. Plus, for a limited time, you can get your first month free. Required talking points. This is written in red. Use your talking points, what? To guide the narrative, but to put it in your own words. Whoops, too late for that. Okay, I think we're good. Keeps.com, KEEPS.com/Anders. That's my name, folks. That's how you get a discount. If you're ready to take action, and prevent hair loss, go to Keeps.com/Anders to receive your first month of treatment free. That's $10 off, y'all. If you do it for a year, that's 8%. Quick math. KEEPS.com/Anders. We do keep customer before and after photos. That's cool. Those are online. You can go look at customer before and after photos. Keeps.com, KEEPS.com/Anders. Bunch of other stuff that they told me not to do. Pretty sure I didn't do it. Anyway, much love to y'all. Check out Keeps.com and check out all of our other partners that support RandomGolfClub.com, and go to RandomGolfClub.com to check out stories, merch, community, and more. Membership coming soon. Bye.
So let's talk about this Brooks Koepka piece for GQ. How many words was it? Do you remember? Do you care? Do you think about articles in that realm?
I do. Just as an editor, I was so in tune with it, you know, where I could probably tell, you know, within a few hundred words. I think that was about 7,500 words or something like that.
So a feature. It's a big deal.
Good length feature.
Yeah. And you spent, how much time on it did you spend?
I was only with him for about 3 days down in Jupiter, where he and so many pro golfers live, which was fun for me as a golf fan who had never kind of dipped into that whole scene down there. And then, yeah, it was probably, you know, a month of additional reporting and writing or something like that. And then we take it through a pretty heavy editorial process. There's, you know, I always warn them about like the fact checking process, which is pretty intense at a lot of those magazines. But it was definitely something that I had been thinking about for a long time too, because the piece is, it's two things. It's a profile of a person who had become suddenly quite well-known, especially in sports, but without having ever done one of these things. And that's like the rare opportunity where you can really get, you've done interviews before, but one where you're going, you know, at GQ, one of the things is a real focus on life off of the field or the course, and kind of what is life really like for this person? What does it feel like to kind of be in their shoes? And sort of be able to be the first place to do a version of that, but also take up a thing that I've been thinking about a lot, just sort of in the back end of the piece, about like what Brooks Koepka's ideas, how they dovetail with what I think to be maybe one of the, you know, sort of what we were talking about, like not a crisis in golf, but one of the conflicts of why it doesn't go wider. And he had a lot of thoughts about that. And that's one of the kind of bones he has to pick. And it has to do with a lot of the things that people know about him, if they know anything about some of his criticism of the game and of other players or of certain rules or of certain standards. And it all kind of comes into this idea of why is golf working so hard to make it unappealing or unapproachable for a certain, you know, additional set of people. I think that Brooks, like fairly or not, has developed this reputation as wishing he played any other sport. You know, he said comments about wishing he had been a pro baseball player and loving, I mean, he just loves football and basketball. And I think that that's a little overstated at this point, in the sense that this is a person who devotes, you know, his entire life to golf. And that's obviously number one, but he's onto something just in the fact of he rolls his eyes at the game, and especially of the sort of fussy attitude of certain aspects of it, as much as a lot of the fans do, I think. And in that way, he has become almost like a populist hero or something, or maybe is on his way to it if he wants to. I think that if he remains in the position that he's in, he could really change certain aspects, you know, if he puts his weight behind certain things. I think he's really found his voice in the last year. I think he was kind of kept to himself a little bit more, but has gotten a lot of positive feedback for him speaking out on certain things like slow play or certain dress code things or whatever. And that'll be really, really interesting to see if like he kind of pushes that a little bit more, sort of like LeBron did when he reached the top and was able to just make little changes here and there. And when he throws his voice behind something, it carries a little extra punch.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, you know, you kind of are thinking about players and as athletes, as people who kind of change throughout their lives. And you're absolutely right. I mean, when the spotlight's on you at first, there's that moment of, oh my God, everyone's listening. I don't want to say anything wrong. But then for Brooks, you know, you go a couple of years and then all of a sudden you're like, you know what? I only practice for the majors, and right, everybody loves it. And it's like, right, we like your take. We want to hear your take. And then all of a sudden, 10 years go by and Brooks is like you kind of positioned, like all of a sudden we care so much about, you know, what he says, and we enjoy his takes. And, you know, that's kind of an interesting way to look at, you know, not only just athletes, but people too. It's like, we we aren't so, it takes a minute to get comfortable with being ourselves. And you have to imagine, I mean, I'm sure that, you know, you've spent so much time around these types, these people who have become so successful at what they do that they become famous. And it's like, it's like, wow, that must be not as easy as I think it is. That must be really hard. That, what is that really like? And that's kind of goes back to what we talked about in the very beginning, which is 10 people look at Jerry Seinfeld, 9 out of 10 say, man, he's got the life. And then that one person says, does he? Does he really? I don't know.
Right. No, absolutely. And one of the you know, main focuses of a lot of that time at GQ was writing not just about athletes, but about directors, about actors, about people who are exactly in the position that you're talking about. A lot of them kind of in an ascendant phase where they're becoming more famous by the day, which is changing them. You know, fewer people who are already at the top, just because that's a complicated place to write about somebody, you know, maybe it's a comeback, things like that. And you kind of get under the surface of that, hopefully, you know, if somebody can be honest about just what the experience of that life is like. And, you know, I think that a lot of celebrities, especially actors and athletes, are told from, I think, a place that is meant to protect them, but ultimately is not great for them, that like they shouldn't say anything interesting because it would potentially be controversial. It might not mean that, it might mean that they won't get their next thing that they're going out for, or the next endorsement or whatever. But it's such a cynical view, I think that these genuinely interesting humans are not capable of like judging for themselves, you know, what is interesting or not, especially in a moment when that authenticity is the key to, if you look at anybody who's successful in those fields right now, it's the people that fans can feel like they're getting a little bit more, and it doesn't feel cookie cutter, and it doesn't feel baked by a publicist. And so it's this strange kind of dance that we do with a lot of those athletes and actors of they want one thing, and they think that the way to do that is to be as anodyne and bland and standard as anyone, when of course, as with Brooks, like you start to talk a little bit and suddenly it's, oh, one of these 10 things might not go well, but the other 9 are showing who you truly are. And that's like such a valuable thing, not just for fans love it, but like you're going to become a bigger entity by speaking your mind. I think generally that's how it goes. And that's always what works. We find with the profiles in particular that give more to us in terms of time, in terms of access, in terms of really getting deep into things. They are the most read, they're the most beloved. We hear from those individuals and subjects on the back end of it that are like, this thing broke through in a way and framed me in a different light, and it feels different than the kind of standard other things I've done. And that's like a very exciting position to be in, where you're, you know, whether you're famous or not, you're kind of helping, I don't know, recast again, bringing freshness to something that feels familiar, I think is really what that is. And with celebrity, that is, that's really complicated, because 90% of what they do is very standard. They maybe don't have a writer or a photographer or whatever who's in that with them, you know, who like really is sort of like, we also benefit from showing you differently than you're perceived, you know. And I think that that's just kind of interesting, each project out. Not everyone goes that way, but when they do, it's really successful. I think that the Brooks thing really worked in that way, where he was like, I am tired of the same questions and the same conversations. And because I understood that, and I think because I knew how to do that kind of story, but also knew my golf, I think that we like vibed pretty quickly right at the beginning, in the sense that it wasn't some person who doesn't know what he's talking about on the golf course also. And in that way, it just was like an exciting project. You break down some barriers and get into some interesting stuff. And I think that everybody wins in that case.
Yeah, I mean, 3 days with Brooks Koepka, you're at his house, you go to the, you hang out with him throughout a lot of his routines. I want to hear about that, but did it change your golf game at all? Did you go out and play differently at all? Did it change your perspective on golf? You talk a lot about his, inaccessibility to emotion, right? When, you know, there's the beginning of it is mostly about one of Brooks, his 15th club, if you will, is that he is not going to show you how he felt about what just happened.
Yeah. I mean, that is just such high level, like, competitor stuff, you know, that you hear about where, right. This was, when he hits his tee shot in the water on 12 at last year's Masters. And that was basically the turning point where he kind of falls out of contention and Tiger ends up winning. But he just described a scene for me, where Tiger was on 11, he's on the 12th tee. He hits a shot in the water knowing that this probably has ended it. And, but doesn't want to react because he knows that Tiger will be watching him to see if it was the wind that knocked his ball in the water because it was a well-struck shot, or if he mishit it in the water, and knowing that his reaction might give Tiger something. And instead he just is completely stone-faced in reaction to that. And I just found that like some high level stuff. I don't know if everybody is looking at him the same way that he's looking at everybody else. I think that he is guessing that Tiger is because he's, you know, modeling some of that competitive stuff off of that guy. But I just love that it's like he's playing a game with everybody else out there, trying to squeeze just little slivers of advantage. And I just found that stuff really interesting because the way that manifests itself on TV, if you don't have an announcer telling you that about him, he just looks super boring. You know, he's not emotional at all. He's completely like not reacting to a birdie or a bogey. It's just like complete concrete. And when you, if you don't know what's actually going on there, that you go, that guy's bland. He's a robot. He's a Terminator grinding through, you know, Bell Revue or whatever. And like, I just love that because it was so different than the thing that has been written about him so much, which is that this guy doesn't feel anything. It's like, oh, actually his, and he knows that he's not showing emotion, but he's like, my mind is going at all moments in all directions with all these other competitors. And he loves leaderboard watching. He wants to know what every player made ahead of him so that he knows that, like, if he sees Rory makes an eagle on 15 or whatever, he knows it's gettable, and that means that he's going to make a three there, whatever that is. Like, I just found that whole, we went actually like hours on that kind of stuff of just kind of getting that really intricate, that competitor stuff that I just don't think, you know, I think that reporting on this sort of stuff in the moment is very difficult. You have to ask super specific questions as a beat reporter. When you get the luxury of sitting down and talking in detail after the fact, you can get some really interesting stuff that he's maybe not going to give you in the locker room or whatever at the press conference.
So when you, I'm curious to know a little bit of like a lens into your world. So you go to meet him. Number one, what do you have with you? Do you have like, you know, what's the exact notebook model, pen, recorder? Is your phone on airplane mode? What are you nervous? What's your version? What's the story? If I was going to write a story about you, where do I start with that?
Well, it's funny. It's basically the same for anybody, whether it's like a FBI agent or an athlete or whatever. It's like, you have a notebook, you have a pen, you have a voice recorder. You're hoping that you can get some sort of ability to spend time with that person or talk to them beforehand to just kind of, you know, loosen up or whatever. We met at this kind of funny place in Jupiter that is a restaurant with the name I'm blanking on, but a bunch of the golfers co-own it with Michael Jordan, and you know, they kind of have like a little membership there, and Gary Player was hanging out, and I guess a lot of the golfers passed through there, and so it was a comfortable place for him. He was, you know, had a few cocktails, knew the menu, you know, it was like very relaxed for him. And that's always easier than when you're like, you know, meeting across a conference room table, and the stakes feel a little less comfortable. And so that's always a good sign if they're drinking in front of you, or they're, you know, just like comfortable in some way. His girlfriend was there. It was a nice dinner, and what's good about that is it kind of locks you into a longer situation too. And so, and then the next day was at the house and the golf course, and once you can establish that thing early, I find that the thing you want is as many interactions as you can, like in number. They don't all have to be quality, but you can get different angles on a thing. And if maybe one of them is not as exciting, then you're going to take a break and come at it. Like, it was nice that we didn't drive to the golf course together. I thought that was useful. He and his caddy, Ricky, like, were in the car in front of me, and that allows him to maybe be like, you know, to reset. He doesn't feel like I'm watching everything. He can joke around with his caddy for a minute, and then, you know, when I'm there, like, it's on. And he knows or should know that, like, anything that's happening is on the record, and if he wants to take something off, he can. But for the most part, like we were talking about, the camera lens is open, and so that's kind of interesting. Is you want to give them breaks so that it doesn't feel like you're just like up in there. Like, I'm in his house. That's quite a lot already. You know, I'm not going to like nose around and go upstairs or something like that. But I'm looking at things. I talk about how, you know, some of the, he has John Rahm's like save the date on his refrigerator in the store and stuff like that. You know, those are not details that you get if you're not invited in. And so, you're just trying to find things that you're not, you know, nothing that's like gonna, that's a superfluous detail that, has no meaning. I think that did because he has a reputation of not being friends with anybody on tour, you know, and here it's maybe just, I think he likes that a little bit more, but actually gets along with these guys fine. And so that's what it is. You're just kind of taking notes. I take a lot of notes in an email draft. And that's more nitty gritty, you know, and so that you don't have to constantly have the book out, and you can look like you're just kind of texting or answering an email or whatever, but you can kind of have your eyes open for things like that. But that's almost for any story, where you're just trying to be, again, just like noticing as much as possible, giving breaks, not wearing somebody down. And when you find them in a topic that you don't want to talk about, we go off on a politics jag at one point, and you know, just trying to kind of be open and polite in that kind of situation. And he had stuff he wanted to say there, which I found really interesting. We got to have follow-up conversations after he played with Trump about that. And, you know, there are lots of interesting ways that could have gone. And you just try to be to open to that and take it where they want to go. And in that way, like, I just love those kinds of things where there was a lot of stuff that happened that I didn't necessarily expect, or things that he was interested in. I mean, you talked about what you get from the golf side. Watching him hit balls up close is pretty different than, I don't know, maybe not every pro, but I go out to maybe two pro tournaments a year or something like that. So it's like, it is a real wake up call to watch ball striking from somebody like that. And yeah, just like, I loved it in the context. He's at this course that he played a lot growing up and in high school, and there's a little high school match of his high school, the girls' team is playing. And, you know, just to watch somebody who came directly up out of that soil, you know, like having reached the pinnacle and just kind of hitting shots out there and the same range that he used as a kid. Like, it's very cool to see that you're watching somebody do something better than anybody else, but it's also not like impossible then to trace how he got there. You can actually see that development. He's not unapproachable or superhuman or whatever. It's just like, wow, this was just like rot from right here. And in that way, it's, you know, it's impossible to imagine hitting a golf ball like that, but it's definitely inspiring to watch.
You said that when you're together, everything's on the record. Is that like a pre-signed contract that they agree to?
Right. So when we sit down, I have a conversation generally where I ask if I can start recording. I usually put my on the table just so that there's like, you know, we know what's going on. And then, yeah, I let them know the rules where it's sort of like we're on unless we're off. And that's the way it usually goes. And there are things often that are said that it's sort of like, well, we'd like to steer away from that. And I can maybe just say like, that's not interesting to me, that thing, you know, that's not going to appear. There's usually especially during the fact-checking process, a moment where these questions come in that are like completely disembodied from the context, you know, and it's like, does Eric like this kind of coffee at, you know, 9 a.m. on Fridays or whatever? And you're sort of like, wait, what is the story about? You know, but it's like, it's maybe just a detail that kind of like made it into the piece, and it's not a big thing being made out of it. But that's usually where the tension starts to come in of like, what is this about? Is this going to be, you know, something off in a corner that we didn't want it to go or whatever? But that usually gets worked out. And you know, we always, I have all the, you know, notes and all the recordings, and you can usually work it out where, you know, if somebody wants to start saying, oh, I didn't say that or whatever, then you kind of get into the, well, we have the thing, and you know, we just want to get to a place where we want to make sure it's accurate. And so in that way, it's like, yeah, everything is on. I think that people get comfortable very quickly. I've noticed over the years where maybe at first it's sort of you've got your guard up a little bit about the recorder going, and it's kind of amazing after an hour or whatever, you know, people, I guess that's what they say about like reality TV shows and stuff too. The cameras just kind of disappear, and suddenly you get a much more kind of fluid conversation going, and you know, that's when things tend to get interesting, is you're not trying to, you know, get somebody, but you do want to get them talking the way they talk and thinking the way they think, and just kind of presenting that faithfully, especially if it's something that people haven't seen before.
Is there anything, like, about to leave the topic of Brooks, but is there anything about this man that you respect more than anything else? Is there something within this sort of portrait that you made of him that you saw, you know what, this really is the thing that's, do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that for me, it was, I love interacting with, meeting with, writing about in particular, people who like really just seem to understand themselves and like are the way they are. And like, even when people push him to like answer questions, like, why aren't you more this or that or the other thing? Like, it hasn't even occurred to him to like be a different version of himself, you know, like it's just sort of like, here's what I like. I've always liked this. I kind of have, you know, been driven in this very specific direction since I was little. Like, he, even before he was winning golf tournaments, certainly before he was like elite level, he thought that he was going to be a pro golfer. It's really the only thing he ever cared about. Had a completely like unfounded confidence in his game, in a way that he had not that kind of confidence in any other aspect of his life. Wasn't great at school, didn't think he probably could have gone to college, like, unless he was playing golf. And so like, he has his friends, his high school friends, his college friends, and everything else is just kind of incidental. I think he's just like, this is my approach to things. And I do love that when you just get somebody who is like, I don't know why I am this way, but I'm probably not going to change very much in one direction or another. It is not what everybody's like. Obviously, there's a lot of people who can be much more fluid and trying to find new things. But it's kind of amazing when you kind of have that faithful representation where I'm like, I deeply believe that what you're saying is true because it's so consistent with everything else.
Your most recent novel. And I'm curious to know how on earth you write a novel. I've never really asked that question of I've never wondered, you know, I think I just accept that they exist in the world and sometimes get turned into movies. Barcelona Days I haven't read it, but I don't read anything. So that's one thing, but it sounds like I would like it. I mean, this idea of, you know, being stuck on a vacation in Iceland, unplanned adventure ensues. Where did the idea come from?
There was a Icelandic volcano in 2000 that erupted, that grounded all.
Did I say earthquake?
And out of, What's that?
Did I say? I think I said earthquake. I was thinking volcano, so I'm clearly.
Yeah, no, right. So there's a volcano in Iceland that goes off and grounds all these flights in and out of Europe, and it was just sort of this weird pause. You know, like we're obviously deeply feeling that now, but at that moment, it was sort of one of these, you know, modern life unprecedented moments where everybody was stuck in place, and I had heard some great kind of stories coming out of there of just things that had gone very differently or blown up or come to be or whatever, all because of this pause that happened. And so in the novel, it's like super specific human drama between these four Americans, but the kind of inciting incident is the is a version of that kind of like Icelandic volcano. The book set in May of 2017, but this couple that's sort of right at this heavy pivot in their relationship, and have decided that they give each other three free passes before getting engaged, and they go on this trip to Barcelona. They confess in this long kind of brutal dinner, at the end of which they decide, okay, we're going to make it, and let's just go home and get out of here. And then they get grounded by this volcano, stuck in Barcelona for 4 days, run into another pair of Americans, and the four of them are just kind of, you know, kind of in this pressure cooker together, trying to figure out their lives right at this fracture point for all of them. But I just love that idea of something in the natural world imposing itself in a way that kind of brings everything in your small, mundane little life, you know, to the surface in that way, where it feels more intense. It feels a lot like what's happening right now, where you're just sort of everything is more intense inside with your family, whoever you're with your coworkers. That pressure cooker quality by something that's so deeply out of our control has been interesting to me since I remember that happening in 2010.
Yeah. So what are you going to title the book about? What's it going to be like? You know, have you thought of a title? COVID days, or is it there's
the quarantine fiction? Yeah, the big shelf of fiction. Like, I saw a funny thing about how you know, introducing the Sundance you know lineup for 2022 or whatever, and it was just exclusively you know coronavirus little dramas inside kind of thing.
Yeah,
but there is an interesting thing where it's I'm sure that genius writers will make great art and drama out of this moment, but boy, does it feel like not what I want to read about right now, you know, or see, where it's sort of like this thing where it's like when this clears finally, you know, fingers crossed that it's just going to be like good riddance to that whole period of time. I don't need to sit in that anymore.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. What has been your outlet in this period of time? I know for me, the thing I did that was, I might do it again. In the beginning of quarantine, I watched Shawshank Redemption. And it just hit me different in quarantine because the dude's in jail. He goes to solitary. He thrives and then he escapes. And I'm like, great, man. So you're telling me I've got about, you know, 2 hours of difficulty and then I'll escape. And where am I going? You know, is it Montana? I don't know. I can't get on a plane. Has any stories that you found throughout the world left you feeling, oh, you know what? It's not that bad. We're going to be okay.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Like, no.
Using the time less to kind of, you know, with the specific like escape on the other side thing, then I like tried to enjoy the pause of like no new stuff in some ways. And like you're talking about going back to, you know, I think that was made in like 94, you know, these books or films from especially the 80s and 90s for me, a lot of, it's funny where I was reading like a lot of books that I read in high school, like rereading them for the first time and just kind of like, okay, here's an opportunity to maybe, I don't know, just engage with a bunch of stuff that because there's not that brand new thing, and of course there's new stuff coming out, but it is maybe a moment to kind of pause and just think about time a little differently in that way, and just like a lot of those classics to take that break and be able to do that. And But yeah, it's challenging. Like I'm not one of these people who like goes and I've noticed that one of the bestsellers right now is about the 1917, flu and people like, you know, sticking their head and that sort of stuff. That's not really me. I'm trying to stay away a little bit, but even, you know, in golf content, it's interesting. Like I've noticed a lot of places kind of, because there's nothing new to talk about in professional ranks, at least like that thing of looking back, it's cool. You know, it's nice to take a moment. And I loved what the Masters did, rerunning all those great kind of classic final rounds and just kind of being able to take a breather and maybe appreciate the history and kind of dip into that a little bit more. It's just not that constant grind of the new thing that you might be missing.
Yeah, I mean, interesting. I mean, from that perspective, I too shared the same kind of pleasure in watching what I already knew the outcome was.
Yeah.
I had never seen the Torrey Pines U.S. Open. That was fascinating, you know. And then it's interesting. I mean, yeah, it's like the more you take away, first of all, more or less from an entertainment perspective, it's like we're fine. There is more than enough stuff to watch and read and listen to. You're totally right. The avalanche of content is not missed, really. I mean, yes, we miss live sport, but do we? Did is it a big difference?
Everybody talks about who, especially who works that I know in covering this sort of stuff. Whether you're a television critic or, somebody who's constantly kind of having to keep up with.
Currently frozen. No.
I'll see for a second, but I kept the answer going, if that's useful. I don't know if you could hear any of that.
I figured you were going to just nail it, and then later on we'll just chop it up. speak of the devil. We're talking of difficulties of making content during these times.
I know. So I think it might be my internet here that keeps dropping out.
It's okay. I mean, we're almost done. I think, I don't really have a follow-up question. I was just going to say, Daniel V. Riley on Instagram, check out Barcelona Days, check out, the work you've done for GQ. I actually read your piece also on watching old golf tournaments, I think. You know, I find them very entertaining, and I look forward to reading your next time that you point the pen at golf, and I think that the world will be a better place for it, and hopefully you do, which is what I think is maybe the most important thing that people can do in your position or my position, which is maybe convince or suggest to those that don't golf that they could try it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just, really appreciate all that you've been doing in that way. Like I said, it's just like a thing that had grown so stale for me for so long after years and years of really, really loving it, and to be re-engaged at the level I am. That's just me personally. And so I can't imagine what it is for people who are coming fresh to it. And kind of just like seeing that new way into it. It's such a great game. It's such an easy thing to kind of fall into obsession with. And there are such rewards if you can find your entry point to it. And so it's nice that there are just more places that are kind of providing those entry points, and obviously the stuff you're doing is part of that. So I'm just a fan and appreciate it.
Thank you, man. The feeling is mutual. I'd like to talk to you for a second when we're done. So let's say goodbye. Thank you, Daniel. I really appreciate it. Again, you're Daniel V. Riley on Instagram. Is there anywhere else where do you, I'm assuming you're not a Snapchat guy.
Not a Snapchat guy. That's good. Twitter is the same thing. Instagram, and then yeah, those books. The first novel's Fly Me, and this new one's Barcelona Days, out next month.
What does the V stand for?
Vroman.
Wow.
Yeah, grandfather's name, Dutch first name.
What a beautiful middle name.
Thank you. Yeah, it's definitely not common.
I like it. How many people ask you what it stands for?
A lot. Sometimes when I'm just doing the, the reading it over my credit card over the phone or whatever, I pick other V names.
What's the common response? What's the best response you've gotten to the reveal of the middle name?
Oh, they still have, they just don't even know what I'm saying. You know, like it's just, what?
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's a familiar name. I feel like I've heard it, but I can't say I have.
One thing that was fortunate growing up in Los Angeles is the big famous bookstore in Pasadena is Vroman's. And so like if you like are over in that area or like grew up kind of going to that place, they at least knew. When my grandfather landed in Pasadena in the 70s, he felt extremely fortunate that, you know, he didn't know that there was a place there, this first place that they'd seen his name before.
My father's middle name is Vern, which is, you know, strange. I mean, not strange, but it's not common anymore.
Right, and you hear and you don't necessarily know what, you know.
Vern. All right, Daniel, well, thank you for your time. I look forward to seeing your next piece.
Thank you. I'm going to stop this now.